Okay, so now we're going to sort of start where we ended off last time. Remember last time I said, break the boundaries, no more comfort level, you have to get on with it? Okay, well, that's what I said for those of you who aren't there. Okay, so what we're talking now is about how to actually have real goals for oneself in changing one's middos and how to achieve them. That's what we're going to talk about. But just by way of preface, again, none of this could be done without breaking the existent borders. That doesn't mean it has to be unpleasant. That doesn't mean it has to be stressful. But you can't move forward and at the same time not move forward. Okay, that's the way it goes. So I'm going to read you brief excerpts from Mesilat Yesharim, and then we'll talk about them. Okay, the first thing that he says that's relevant to our purposes is that for a person to go through life without introspection, okay, is like a person who's driving a car. He doesn't say a car, but whatever. A person who's driving with their eyes closed. Okay, so if you're driving with your eyes closed, the accident is invariable. And no amount of having other people improve the road is going to do anything for you. So the idea is as follows. Our days aren't like stories. Stories, those of you who ever took literature courses are familiar with this idea. What makes something a story is the introduction of characters, the conflict, and the resolution. But our lives don't work like that usually, because one thing leads smoothly and almost seamlessly into the next thing, so that we don't stop and question anything. So I'll give you a simple example. Let's say we're trying to marry off one of your children. So finding the right person is only step one. Then there's, of course, the other steps with making it happen. Then there are the technical preparations for the wedding and for their future, right? So none of these have defined beginnings or end. So you could reach a point where you don't even think about the wonder of your son or daughter having actually found the right person because you're too busy negotiating for money with the in-laws. Okay? Yeah. And your sense of wonder of having survived that, okay, is soon eclipsed with wondering how necessary a couch really is. Okay, clear? So one thing eclipses another thing, so we don't notice the stories. So because of this, a person has to be very clear not only about where they want to go, which we're going to talk about soon, but about where they were already, so they could know what works and what doesn't work. So because of this, he says, and I quote, okay, one moment. Inyan hazihiva tushya adam nishar b'masav uv'inyanav. Klamar, mitbonen u'mefakeach al masav v'drachav. Hatovim heim im lo. Okay, so he says a person has to look at two things. One is what he actually does, and the other is whether the way he does what he's doing is good. You could be aiming at the right things, but the way you go about getting them is not necessarily right. So when you review your life, which you have to do before you review tomorrow, you have to look at yesterday and today, the main thing you're looking at is which choices got you to where you want to be in life and whether the way you walked on that road was good or not. Let's define good. So in ordinary language, the way people define good usually has to do with either aesthetic, something looks good, feels good, tastes good, or it has to do with practicality, it worked. But there's a third meaning of good. The third meaning of good is it reveals Hashem. So a problem we have it's not just linguistic. We confuse all three of these. Something that feels good, we sometimes think is good. Something that is appealing, we sometimes confuse with something that's good. So what we're saying is, did you draw closer to Hashem or not? What actually got you there and how did you go there? Which means we have to define what being close to Hashem means. So in order to go there, let's think about drawing close to another person. There's an interesting halacha. The halacha is, if you give someone a gift, should you let them know or shouldn't you let them know? Which is better?
It depends what you want.
So it's a Jewish answer. It depends. Okay. If the purpose of your giving the person of the gift is because they have a need that they can't meet on their own, then it's best to be anonymous. But if the purpose of the gift is to make a bond between you and the other person, then you shouldn't be anonymous. You should say, I care about you. That's why I bought this for you. That's why I gave it to you. So similarly, if Hashem wants to give us a gift, okay, there are things he gives that we need where he doesn't, so to speak, sign his name. We breathe his air and we don't even notice that that's what's happening. We eat his food and listen to our vocabulary. I made a great eggplant parmesan. Oh, I did? Let's think about this. I took existent eggplants and mixed it with existent ingredients, put it in my oven that was made out of other existing metals, and then attributed it all to who? Myself. Okay, so Hashem doesn't sign his name on this. He conceals himself in nature. So we could find him there, and the means of finding him there is halacha. There's a bracha to be said on the eggplant, etc. But he's concealed in nature. But there are other gifts that he gives us that are gifts of love. What are the gifts of love? The gifts where we could say, Baruch Atah Hashem, etc. Asher kedishanu b'mitzvotav. You've given me your mitzvah. A mitzvah is a gift of self. When you do a mitzvah, Hashem isn't giving you something other than him. He's giving himself. So to understand that better, let's think of gifts that we would hold precious. Okay, suppose somebody gave you a gift and you thought that they bought it themselves, or at least chose it themselves, or at least paid for it themselves, and later you found out that somebody gave it to them and they sort of passed it on to you. Okay, this happens with wedding gifts a lot. They sometimes make the whole sivuv. Okay, but wait a minute, my name isn't Leah. Okay, whatever. Okay, so in any case, so it doesn't mean as much because you know how people will say it's not the gift, it's the giver. There's a certain amount of truth there. So let me illustrate this. Be very immature. Think of yourself at five. You there? What would be a dream present for a five-year-old?
A toy.
What toy? A bicycle, right? Okay, now if you're five, does it matter who gave you the bicycle?
No.
Nope, couldn't care less, okay? So if somebody who loves you gave you, let's say, a nice warm winter sweater, and somebody who owes your father money gave you a bicycle, you would like the bicycle better anyway, right? Okay. Now be 15. What's a dream gift for a 15-year-old? A car. Does it matter who gave it to you? Does it matter?
No.
Matters a little bit more. So if you got a car from your parents, let's say, because you finish school and they're so proud of you or whatever at 15. Okay, whatever. Okay, but it would mean more than if you won it in a raffle. Okay, not that much more, but more. Okay, now move further up. Still, you're 48. Your husband gives you a gift for your anniversary. And he went through a lot of trouble choosing it, but it doesn't work. Okay, could that happen? He gave you a piece of jewelry that you don't like, that you would never, ever, ever have chosen on your own. Could this happen? Which is why when the salesman in the store saw him coming, and he said, gosh, I'm not sure what to buy with his wife. He said, here, they all love this. Okay, yeah. Okay. So, does it still mean something to you?
Yeah.
Oh, because you're not a five-year-old. Okay, clear? So what? The reason why it means something to you, and you may even wear it, at least in the house, is is because you want to show him that you value his having selected the gift for you, right? So what makes you value it is that there's something of him in the gift. Okay, now picture yourself as an elderly sage. Okay, there you are. Is there any gift a person can give you that means anything? So I want to share with you something I actually saw. Okay, some of you may be familiar with Rav Tzvi Kushelevsky. Do you know who I'm talking about? He has a yeshiva in Yerushalayim. So his parents used to be my neighbors. So I became friends with his mother, who's quite an elderly lady, who's an incredible, brilliant, interesting woman. So I actually saw this. I was visiting with his mother, and his father at that point was towards the end of his final illness. He was gravely ill. Rav Tzvi dropped by. He gave his father, he brought him a gift. It was a fragment of something written by the Rambam in the Rambam's own hand. This must have cost a small fortune. Okay, clear? Did it mean a lot to Rav Tzvi's father, who was so gravely ill, who surely wouldn't be using this much longer? Of course it did. Of course it did, both for the effort that it reflected, the way it shows that he sees his father as a person who would appreciate something of this nature. You understand this? So you have somebody giving of themselves to someone who sees this as a gift to themselves. This is the opposite of a five-year-old. Okay, clear? When Hashem gave us the mitzvot, he gave us himself. He gave us himself. As we said before, those of you who were here, the mitzvot are contractions of his will and wisdom. So Hashem, who's infinite and invisible, could be found in a piece of bread. He gave us himself. But not only that, and this is what we didn't speak about previously, the mitzvot are designed by Hashem to mirror what bonds us to him within us. They bring forth our spiritual traits. So they give us a bond that's absolute between ourselves and him. So if you're talking about what did Hashem give us that's good, this is far more than all of the gifts of nature. This is where he gives us himself. So when you're talking about what we just read now, are our ways good or not good? That means are the choices we make, do they lead us to giving ourselves to Hashem in return, our highest selves, or not? And is the way we give them, are we using the part of ourselves that makes us closer to Hashem in our midos, or not? So there's a mitzvah in the Torah, v'halachta b'drachav, go in Hashem's ways. So it isn't do what he does, which is beyond what we could do, but the way we do whatever we do, the style that we do whatever we do, should be similar to him. So the midot that are described in Chazal, walk in his ways, what's that? Mahu rachum afatahei rachum. Mahu chanun afatahei chanun. Mahu kadosh afatahei kadosh. So there are three that are isolated, although there are surely more. So let's look at these three, and then we'll go back into Mesilat Yesharim for a moment. Mahu rachum, we should be compassionate. You could do all sorts of things uncompassionately that are good things. Give me an example of something good that you could do compassionately or non-compassionately. You can give tzedakah with compassion, or you can give tzedakah without compassion. So I'll give you an example of this. Okay, some of the beggars at the Kotel are difficult people, okay? And in fact, internationally, but I say there's a particular woman beggar who's very difficult. No matter where I've spoken, she's, yeah, I know who you mean. She's like, you know, she's not anonymous, okay? So I had a student from California, okay, who's a masseuse, right? She's from California, so that fits, okay? And she'd go to the Kotel. She had a little apartment in the old city. And she got to know this very difficult woman beggar who, like, throws back your money and curses and this and that. And she says to her, I was there, so she was using me to speak Hebrew. And my Hebrew's good, but, like, I couldn't find the word. She said, you, like, seem so, like, stressed and tense. So I translate, and she says, Ken? And she's like, I'm a masseuse. Like, you should come up to my studio. I'll give you a massage. So she did. So I want you to picture this woman in the studio. Okay, you could see her. There she is on the table with the oils and, like, the music and, you know, the whole. She was mellow for a half a year after that. So I'm not sure. She really was. It took her a long time to get back to her usual feisty self. So the reason I'm telling you this is that this girl was a person who could do rachum. Rachum isn't pity. I want to tell you what rachum is. The word rachum comes from the word rechem, which means womb. The womb provides the perfect environment for someone to grow. Rachum. Okay. Womb. Yes. Rachum's root is rechem. Okay, so that means you could be the safe environment for someone. You could be the environment that makes someone grow, where it's okay to be with you. Or you could be the opposite. You could be a person who's critical and judgmental enough that nobody could allow themselves to show even the tiniest opening in their armor. Could you see where this is so? So if you're doing things, do it as a person who's rachum. Be safe. Be nurturing. Okay. Another example. You go to a parent-teacher's meeting. Okay. So those of you who went to seminary will remember this. When they teach you how to do a parent-teacher's meeting, it's not like spontaneous klutziness. So I tell you, you always have to begin by saying something nice about the child. Okay? So, you know, you open the notebook and you say, you know, okay. So, your daughter's so high-spirited and adventurous. Translate that one.
Wild.
Wild and undisciplined, okay? And then you go on a little bit and she's so friendly. Translate that. She doesn't stop talking for a minute. And then comes the critical word. What's that? But. And then you have to tell the person, you know, what it is. But if she would do her homework every day, then, you know, then she would understand what's going in the class so much better. Okay, or whatever. Okay, do parents feel safe with teachers? No, and I want to tell you why. There are a lot of teachers who are not emotionally safe, who do judge you and who will even talk to you about you. This could happen. Do all teachers feel safe with all parents? No, because the parents do judge them and sometimes even talk about them. Okay, clear? You have to be a safe environment. If you have something negative to say to a person, they have to know that you'll say it to them and not what? About them. You have to be safe. Okay, in marriage, one of the lines in Esh Eschayil is Batach Ba'alev Bala, her husband could trust her. Are all wives trustworthy? So I want to tell you something. In the absolute sense, I'm sure everyone in this room is. There's Chas V'Shalom, no, nothing promiscuous, nothing arayos that could happen here. But there are different levels of being trustworthy. Being trustworthy means being on that person's side. That they can count on you, you're on their team, and not on somebody else's team. Only two generations ago, and I want to tell you, marriages were not perfect then. But one thing that they can count on two generations ago was that their spouse was absolutely loyal. Could you see where this is so? They could scream, they could yell, they could, you know, whatever. But they're loyal. So if a man lost his job in the 40s, he can come home like a Shever Kli, and he could say, they fired me. And he can count on this, I think your boss is a, you know, like whatever. Today, what could he say? What did you do? Okay, clear? Okay, or how did you let that happen? You understand what I'm saying? You have to be trustworthy. That means you have to let your husband know that no matter what, you're on his team. And as I said, two generations ago, marriages were not perfect. People spoke with less refinement than they speak now, in general. But there was safety. So if something has to be said, you could say it in a way that's safe. Every so often in marriage, a husband will confess a frailty to his wife. He'll confide something emotional to her. My father never loved me because I disappointed him. I wasn't like my brother Reuven. If you ever use that against him, no matter how angry you are, what will invariably happen? He will never tell you anything like that again because you're not safe. You have to be safe with your kids. Okay, most kids don't tell their parents hardly anything. Okay, could you see where this is so? They'll talk about what's happening, sometimes ceaselessly, but they don't trust their parents enough to say what's really happening in them. Okay, so your kid comes home, especially teenagers, a kid comes home from school. What's up? What's new? What's the usual answer?
Nothing.
Nothing. What happened in school today?
Nothing.
Nothing. Right. So, okay. Okay. What Gemara are you learning now? Oh, the usual one. You know, Yevamos. Okay. Following the Shiurim. Okay. Okay. So, what do you think about it? Nothing. Okay, clear? So, why do kids do this? It isn't because they don't like to talk. They could be on the phone with their friends for hours. It's because we often aren't safe. And I want to explain to you how this happens. It's not always a fault. Some of it is inherent. What children want most of all from when they're tiny is what? They want to know that you think they're okay. They want this so badly. They want our approval. Okay, a little child will pick up a million Duplo for raisins. It's not just the raisins, although it is also the raisins, but it's also your approval. Okay, could you see where this is so? Their greatest dread is losing your approval. If you disapprove very frequently, then they have nothing to lose, which is a very difficult thing to happen in a family. Okay? So, how do you create a situation whereby they could feel safe with you?
You tell them that what they did is wrong, but it's not them, it's their action.
Okay, hi. What did you do in school today? Nothing. What did you learn? Nothing. Well, it's okay, whatever happened. I know you're okay, but... No. So you have to, in a general sense, create an environment by letting them know in all sorts of ways how much you approve of them in a basic sense. So I want to tell you how. Here are some things that don't work. Telling a child, I love you, you're wonderful, you're my little princess, takes you so far and no further because they don't believe it unless you back it up with something. You understand what I mean? So saying, you set the table. That is so nice of you. Boy, when I come into a room and see a table set like that, it makes me feel like I'm the top of the world. That says something because it resonates as real. Telling somebody you're my little princess when they look in the mirror and they don't see a princess, either because of their dimyon or because of their reality, doesn't do it. Okay, clear? So you have to notice all of this stuff. You can't say it unless you notice it. Okay, clear? Another thing that makes a child feel beloved enough to feel safe is if they see that you really want them to be happy. How could they tell that you want them to be happy? If they see that you do things for them that you know will make them happy. It sounds very basic, but it's not so basic. If you do things that show that your happiness, their happiness is on your mind. For instance, even in simple things, if you know that your kid likes cut up red peppers, putting cut up red peppers in her lunch bag is a message. Giving her a pepper and a knife is It's a different message. You may need to do that sometimes if you're time stressed, but it's still a different message. Okay? Noticing, if you go shopping with the child, noticing their taste. Okay? Look, here's something else that's in the same brown that you liked in the tights. Do you like it in a skirt? Okay? That shows that you're there, that you're on their team. When kids do something wrong, as they do all the time, okay, you have to be careful of two things. One is that the passion you show for their misdeeds doesn't totally eclipse the passion that you show for their good deeds. So it's very easy to get into this. A kid does everything right. You say, oh, that's nice. They do something wrong, and you what? You fly, okay, you lay into them. So the reason why is in our minds we'll say, well, doing this is only expected. It's only normal to do this. But what they hear is that this is more important to you than the other is. So there's a gap between what we're thinking and what our kids hear. Okay, clear? They hear, for instance, if they come home, let's say with a moderately good report card, not a hugely good report card, a moderately good report card with, let's say, an 82 average. Okay, clear? It's not fantastic, it's good. If you look it over and it takes 2 minutes or less, and you say, it's pretty good, okay, what's the message they just got?
Not good enough.
Not good enough. But if you say, well, like you even got 82 in geometry. Geometry was hard for you this term. I remember you worked hard for that 82. I remember you calling up your friends and doing homework together. No, you got something for it. See, it worked. Okay, clear? Yeah?
Let's say a child comes home with a test.
Yeah.
And 74. And the child, I'm so sad. I didn't get a better grade. And you say to the child, I know you worked really hard. And what really counts is the effort. And I'm proud of you, even if you got a 74. And she said, no, what counts is
no,
the
that's grade. Right. That's right. She's not going to say that. For the same reason as I told you, telling someone you're a little princess, doesn't carry water. Talking about an actuality does. If you tell them that the grade doesn't matter and they go to a school in which the grade absolutely matters, then what you're saying has no credibility.
You could say that I know you worked really hard and I'm proud of you that you worked so hard.
In school, the grade matters. So what you could say,
to the school, not to the mother.
And to their friends,
and to the child,
but
there's a way to convey to the child that it does not matter to you, to your life, to the next 50 years, what you got under the test.
So you have to back it up with concrete stuff, saying it doesn't matter to me, Motik, isn't going to do it. So what you could say in that instance is, the more factual you could be, the better it is. Your father didn't like geometry either. You have to do your best. You know, that's how it is. You have to do your best. You're doing your best. But siyata deshma, you won't do any worse than we did. Okay, let's say your husband's an Eloi, and that's not credible. I didn't like geometry that much either, or if that's not true, since you don't lie to your kids. You know, everybody has subjects they don't like that much, and they're hard to study for. That's the way it is. I'm sure you would have liked to get 100, but you know, this is your hard subject. You did your best. Let go of it.
Isn't it better first, though, to acknowledge the child feels this about themselves? Because then I feel that, you know,
you must be disappointed you got a 74. Yeah, that's reasonable to say. But telling them straight out that it's irrelevant makes them not want to tell you anything about school because you're out of touch with what's happening in their lives. Okay, in the same way that with a younger child, if they come home and say, everybody laughed at me, if you say something like, but I don't laugh at you, I think you're my wonderful little boy. It's not going to do it. It's not going to do it.
So what do you say?
So you could say, that's terrible. It must have been so embarrassing. Okay, then you have two options because you have to do a reality check. Sometimes kids bring things upon themselves, sometimes they don't. So you would have to say, what actually happened? And listen and tell them what you heard. So if from what you're hearing, it seems to be problems having to do with the politic of the class, because kids do zero in on someone sometimes, you would have to say, you know, these kids, when they get older, they're going to be embarrassed by this. One day they'll look back and they're going to say, I didn't do the right thing. You could back that up with a couple of Sipuri Tzadikim of Tzadikim who are sensitive to other people. But you have to move on, so you'll never do this to anybody. Because I know you learned how this feels. That's what you have to learn from this. You'll never do this to anybody. Okay, clear? But just saying, it doesn't matter, you're my sweetie child, like, it's not credible. Okay, clear? It doesn't make you safe, it makes you disattached. Yeah?
What if a child has become aware that other people cheated on that test?
Yeah.
Let's say their grade was lower, mm-hmm. They know the other students didn't deserve what they received.
Right. So I have to tell you the truth. When I went to school, everybody cheated hard. So I don't know. So I'm not as scandalized as I should be, but I remember how shocked I was when one of the girls in my class, I think it was Faggy Adler, wouldn't give answers to anybody because it was like so outrageous. Like, how could you not give answers? But whatever. So you would have to tell them, yes, they got better grades. Okay, yes, grades matter. You have to tell them that because they do. In school life, grade matters. In life, it's not going to matter. You have to tell them that straight. In life, nobody cares. You know me. Who's my best friend? They'll say, you know, Mrs. Kagan. When was the last time she asked me what I got in geography? Okay. She cares. She's my friend because she knows that when she talks to me, I'll give her a true answer. Okay? Cheating on a test doesn't make you into the kind of person that you want to be or that other people will value. That you could tell them. Okay, yeah?
What about if you have, like, older kids who are brilliant?
Who are what?
Brilliant, straight mm-hmm. kids,
yeah.
And younger ones who want to be like the older
kids. Right. So in every family, there's some of that. Their children have different abilities. So there's also, and I'm going to put this out also, different children also have different middos. So some children are lucky enough to be born with a kind of middot that a little bit of positive enforcement and they're with you. And other kids are born with a kind of middos where unless they get a lot of negative enforcement, they're just not with you. You understand what I mean? And this is a matter of personality. So you could have two children sharing the same room. You get them up at the same time in the morning. So you say one of them, get dressed quickly and you'll have time for milk chocolate. Okay, he gets dressed quickly, he gets milk chocolate. The other one, I don't know if you've ever seen how long it could take a 9-year-old to put on a shoe. It could be like, it gives the word Ein Sof a whole new and more fancy type. You know, like you leave the room, they're like this. These are the two laces. And you come back 15 minutes later and they're... Okay. So he's not going to get his milk chocolate, and not only that, he's going to get you saying, why? Because you want him on that bus. Get dressed! Okay? The bus is going to be here in like 2 minutes. Get dressed. Come on. Tie the laces. Okay? And he'll get out that way. Okay, so they're both leaving to school in a totally different state, even though you woke them up at the same time. Okay, clear? So kids have to realize one thing. Everybody is different. You cannot play, otherwise you're going to end up like buying 8 bicycles every time you have a birthday. Okay? You have to realize that everyone's different and your role as a parent is to give everyone what they need. The kids have to hear that in a million different ways. He needs me to remind him a lot of time to get off. You don't need it. Okay. He got 74. He worked just as hard as you did for your 100. That's the way it goes. Math's not his favorite his subject. They have to hear that everybody is different and the difference is okay and that you as a parent are committed to giving everybody what they need, that you are not going to relate to them as though each one of them is exactly the same as everybody else. Having said that, okay, having said that, that's the yesod. If you see that by giving a child something tangible that they need creates jealousy, you sometimes are better off not giving it to them, even if they feel resentful, because of where that will lead them in the politic with their brothers, with their siblings. So you have to be smart there. Okay, clear? Yeah?
I have a different question on not school grades. Because how does
does something, they do the right thing. And they say it didn't pay off at the end, because not every time it pays off.
Right.
For example, my daughter was in Kansas here, so she did twice the right thing, what she was supposed to do, and she worked very hard. And she wasn't chosen for this or that. And she tells me, you know, it doesn't pay off to do the right thing, because it worked so hard.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, nobody acknowledges it.
So let's define the right thing. If the right thing means doing what she thinks in camp will get her to whatever goal she has.
Not necessarily.
Or are you talking morally right?
Yeah.
So if you're sure you're...
She didn't do it because she thought it will, but the fact that nobody acknowledged it, that's what hurts.
That's what I'm saying. So it all depends on what it is. In other words, if it is something that really has no moral significance, like doing well in Machanayim, okay? And, you know, she was the best in Machanayim, but she still didn't get chosen in the team that faced off against the other team for color war. That's one issue. If there's a moral thing, it's a different issue, okay? Let's look at the non-moral issue first. So somewhere along the line, you're not going to like what I'm saying, kids have to learn that if they put themselves in the hands of other people, life isn't always fair. So it's not always worth putting yourself. You're right. If you play Machanayim and the only reason you're doing that is to be chosen into the better of the two teams, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. If you like playing Machanayim, it's worth it. If you don't like it, it's not worth it. There's no moral issue here. They have to learn that they don't have to do things to please other people if there's no inherent value in what they're doing, because sometimes they'll get to that goal, pleasing the other person and getting reward, and sometimes they won't. Okay? Now, if there's a moral issue at stake, for instance, let's say your daughter befriended a girl. You know, children often, as I told you, zero in on whoever is most vulnerable. In camp this happens, like in camp, because they don't have adult supervision. It's oftentimes worse than it is in school. So sometimes in a bunk, especially with kids, I'd say the prime age for that is around 12. They'll zero, and girls do this more than boys, they'll zero in on whoever's most vulnerable. So if it's the foreign girl, it'll be the foreign girl. If you transfer her out into another bunk, it'll be the fat girl. If you transfer her out, it'll be the ones with the least fashionable clothes. You know what I'm saying? Because it doesn't have that much to do with the victim. It has more to do with their own insecurities. So let's say she wouldn't play the game. She wouldn't mock or ostracize or exclude the girl who's being victimized. And because of that, she ended up grouped with her, which could happen. So you would have to tell her the truth. The truth is, this could happen in life. But in terms of becoming the kind of person that you want to be, that I want you to be, and what these girls will admire when they're a little older and smarter, what you did got you closer to that. So they have to learn to differentiate between what feels good right now, this minute, and who they'll be later and what will be admired later. You could say, look at all the biographies we have in the house. None of them have stories about how somebody abused somebody else. There's stories about how people had, you know, okay, clear? So you have to get them on track, but you have to always differentiate between moral issues and things that are mabekach. Okay, yeah?
What do you do if something happens in school and either the teacher or principal is not happy about it and you don't think it was such a terrible thing?
Yes.
What do? You trade the teacher to your child and say...
No.
No, right. But yeah. You also don't want your child to feel like, oh, that was so terrible what you did.
So I have very bad news for you on this. Okay, you have to back up the school. Okay, they could be... In Israel, I'm sure there's even more nonsense about many issues. I remember once, this is like such an American thing to happen. In Har Nof, there are two Beis Yaakovs, the one that's on Kablan and the one that's on Chai Taib. The one that's on Chai Taib has a larger American population. The one that's on Kablan has a higher Israeli population. They both have very rigid dress codes. Okay, so one of the things that are usher on the dress codes are sneakers. Not allowed to wear sneakers. So, of course, the American's mothers say, what are you, crazy? What's wrong with sneakers? what is wrong with sneakers? I mean, like, if Moshe Rabbeinu came back, he'd wear sneakers. Like, what is that? What's wrong with sneakers? What is wrong with sneakers? So what did they do, the American parents? Because they grew up in America, where America, where autonomy is a supreme value. They complained a lot, encouraged their daughters not to listen and to kvetch, and in the end, they even demonstrated in front of the school with placards.
Oh, my God.
Could you imagine this? Okay. Now, how do you think the Israeli Menahelet responded to all of this?
Crazy.
First of all, crazy Americans, which makes that all of the Americans will have more trouble getting their kids into school. Okay. Followed by what? You've got it. But if you don't like this school, I didn't force you. It is not the place for you. You need a place where there's more freedom and more autonomy. Have you tried? Okay, got the picture? Okay, you have to back up the school. So what you could say is usually what the school wants would be more than what you want, not less than. You tell them in language, meaning words, don't leave to their imagination. What do they want? They want you to be more neat, more tsanua, more mesuder, better home. What do they want from you? They're not telling you to do avodah zarah, gilei arayos, or shfichus damim. Okay, you don't have to be moiser nefesh, not to, you know, to have the right to be minimally tsanua. Okay, you could go beyond your comfort level. Matel v'manayim. You have to put it to them right that way. If this is the school you chose, you have to be with them 1,000% if they want more in any direction, no matter how extreme it is. Because otherwise you put your kid in this quandary. Either they'll approve of you and not learn that much from the school and learn, there's what we say and what we do. Or they'll go for the school and they'll think of you as what?
Troublemaker?
As being a person with little authority, little credibility. Okay, either way, you've just taken authority in their life and divided it in two, which doesn't benefit anyone. But what I will say, having given you this whole mouthful, be careful to see that the school you select is a school you could live with. Okay, wait, you had asked, anyone else has anything else? Okay, I'll just hear you for now, but then I want to go back into our text. Yeah?
I just want to say that the school was wrong.
Mm-hmm. That's why I said you have to select. You have to see that you choose a school you could live with. So there are three things you always have to look at. First of all, the same way when you get on a bus, you have to know where it's going. Like the fact that it's air conditioned, there are lots of empty seats, you could even get one with a view. Okay, you have to know where it's going. You look at the kids who graduated and say, is this what I want my chapter 10 to be? If the kids who graduated are not what you want your kids to be like, then it's the wrong school. Next, if the style of the school is radically different than the style of the home, you're going to end up creating conflict. So if you're more mellow and the school is more rigid, you're going to be in conflict. Look for a place where the style is more similar. Notice I didn't say that mellowness is inherently better than rigidity. Okay. And the third thing, and this is especially relevant where you don't have a lot of selection in school, which is that you have to accept that all schools are imperfect. And you have to ask for siyata dishmaya. Without siyata dishmaya, you're going to be in big trouble. But you have to do your best by looking at what the kids who finish actually are like. If your kid doesn't belong in that mode, then you have to do your best to find something alternative. Okay, yeah?
I just wanted to say that there also sometimes are teachers that are maybe different from the school.
Right.
For example, Hachu.
Right.
For example, Hachu. Mm-hmm. A boy in Cheder, I mean, maybe it doesn't happen in Eretz Yisrael, but
she has a sense of humor, yeah. Yeah.
Right. So what do you do? They used to say, so slap him on the other cheek. But I don't believe in that. Like,
you should slap the Rebbe on the other cheek.
No, that's right. Exactly what you should do. But I'm saying the kid comes home and says, yada, 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 what happened? And the Rebbe did, you know, and it used to be, well, what did you do? Well, I'm going to, you know.
You're not going to like what I say. Okay. Okay, I'm still going to say it. I'm going to tell you three things about patching.
But the principle
Right.
Okay.
What I am going to tell you, especially with boys,
yes,
is that virtually all from educational systems that have produced Gedolei Yisrael.
Okay.
You know, how did the Chafetz Chaim, what was his school like, what was the Brisker Rav school like? They all were patched. Okay, every last one of them. Okay, so if it was the formula for disaster that American parents seem to think it is, one would expect more disastrous results. Okay, that's one thing to bear in mind. The other thing to bear in mind is that there's a vast difference between a patch given from a place of hostility and anger and one that's part of, how shall I phrase it, the Yerushalmi venue of elementary school education, where one of my kids had a Rebbe, who he likes very much, Atayom. He had two sticks on the desk. One was very small, it was like a popsicle stick, and the other one was twice the size. And he introduced himself on the first day, picks up the popsicle stick and says, "Wie heißt das?" Which means, what's this called? And the kids, like, said, popsicle stick. And said, nein, chinuch. Then he picked up the bigger one. So he says, wie hast du, which he never used, okay? So they're all saying, big stick. And he says, no, heilige chinuch. So they realize that there's a big difference between that and the kind of slap that would be given out of hostility. I'm not convinced that speaking harshly to children is always better.
When I say patch, I also mean psychological patching.
Okay.
As well as physical patch.
Right.
That type of teacher.
Right. Or, you know, like whatever.
Pick up for that type of teacher.
So now I'll go. Just having put in my two cents about patching.
Okay.
I have to. Today it's very fashionable to say that no patching should ever happen under any circumstance, which somebody I know asked Rebbetzin Volbe, is it true that in your house there was never any hitting? And she said, he certainly didn't hit them. Okay. So with the boys.
But Revolvi also said not to hit unacceptable.
Nobody thinks you should hit. There's nobody who thinks you should just hit out of anger.
No, I mean not to hit. No, but he
He held that no one should hit.
Right.
He didn't hit.
His wife did.
Because the wife was the one who had to get the kids into bed, and he was not. Okay, so what I'm saying, especially with boys, more than with girls, I can't imagine it being justifiable to hit a girl physically because they understand words better than boys do. When they're extremely wild, sometimes one slap eliminates the need for a lot of yelling and unpleasantry and it turns the volume down. Okay, somebody asked the stipler if he was ever hit as a child. And he said, not only was I hit, but I was hit, not the stipler, excuse me, Rav Kanievsky. This is just recent. They asked Rav Kanievsky if he was ever hit. He said, not only was I hit, but I wasn't just hit by my father, the stipler, who was a very severe person. But his personality was very severe. He said, my uncle hit me. Now, the Chazon Ish was a very gentle person. So he said, what happened? So he said, we were on the bus, and we were going from Tel Aviv to Bnei Brak. And I was running up and down the aisles like a maniac. And my uncle said, sit down, it's a Chilul Hashem. And I kept right on running up and down the aisles. And he said, finally, when I got back to this end, he pulled me down by my shirt sleeves, and I escaped. I went back. Second time, he said, he pulled me down by my shirt sleeve, and he gave me a slap, and I sat down nicely like a good boy all the way back to the neighborhood. And that's the way it is. But what I will talk about is teachers who deal inappropriately with their frustrations. So it doesn't matter whether it's hitting or screaming or whatever. Okay, some teachers don't know how to deal with their frustrations. So you have to be extremely careful. You have to hear the three klelim. Hear what the child says and mirror it back. You have to hear what they say. You mean when the class was so noisy, she hit you? He threw you off the chair? Okay, he said, that's it, I said, sit down? Okay, he said, is that what happened? Okay, that must have felt terrible, especially in front of everybody. Boy, that must have felt really terrible. So what are you talking about now? The child and his feelings. You're not talking about the teacher at all.
Right.
Next step, when the child isn't around, you have to call the teacher. Did I say the principal? No, I said the teacher. And you have to ask them what happened. Now, sometimes you get surprises in answer to that question. Sometimes your child told you half a story. So after I told him so many times that if he pushes other children near that open window, he could. Okay, sometimes, you know. I remember one of my sons once came home. One day he'll find out I tell the whole world this story. But he came home, he was four, and he says, the Rebbe on the tender doesn't hit me anymore. So I flipped out. What do you mean he doesn't hit you anymore? Okay, so I finally pulled the story out of him. He said, this is like, because I don't open the door when it's moving anymore. So I said, but didn't he tell you? Yeah. So sometimes, you know, you do get more of a story, but sometimes the more you hear, the worse it is. You know what I mean? The teacher says, I'll tell you what happened. He was mitchatzef, and I hold that if a kid is mitchatzef, you have to, rah, 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 rah. You know, like, sometimes, you know, sometimes the more the teacher tells you, the more you get it. The kid was right. So at that point, your next move is still with the teacher. Still with the teacher, you could say, we're partners in the child's chinuch. With him, this isn't good. It's going to make him hostile. It's going to make him angry. It's going to make him embittered. I want a commitment from you that we could try together to find other ways of disciplining. We could speak to a mechanech. We could do whatever we want. But I can't. You're my shliach. I can't have this. Okay? This sometimes works. And what it sometimes does lead to, this is a time commitment, is that the parent and the Rebbe will sit in front of the Menahel or the Mifakeach or whomever and talk about alternative ways of response. If this doesn't go, you have to go to the Menahel. Okay, clear? But during all of this time, the most the child should know is that you're talking to the teachers about it. Okay, clear? What, that idiot? He did what? I'll sue him. Okay, whatever you know. Okay. Okay, there was a mice in one of the chadarim in Yerushalayim where a child, actually, who's bright, who reads the newspapers, actually called the authorities on one of the rebbes. So the bottom line there was what? What's the predictable bottom line there? He was not only expelled from that school, but no other school would take him. That was.
Weiss thought he hit the stick and never told anybody he hit it.
That's clever. I did something very similar. I stole one of my teacher's grade books. I did that. Okay, whatever. But in any case, what? And this is on tape. Who knows? Okay. So. In any case,
these people that advocate hitting today, most all the professionals and therapists and mechanchim say hitting will teach the child to hit, that it's okay to hit, that somebody bigger and more powerful than you, all you have to do is be strong and blah blah blah, all that stuff. The people that advocate hitting in chinuch, they know.
I'll tell you the line. Yeah. Here's the line. I hit him yesterday. Now he's hitting his brother today. You're not his father, you're not his Rebbe. Keep your hands to yourself. They get that. Okay, got this. That's in fact a line that you've passed by our house, you may hear frequently. Okay, whatever.
But they don't think they're getting a double message.
No, if you're the one inch, they have to get that the person who's hitting or yelling has their benefit and chinuch in mind. If they don't get that message, then there's something inherently wrong with it. And it doesn't matter if it's hitting. It could even be gently spoken words. Okay, it could be, you'll never get into a good yeshiva katana. That's a lot worse than hitting. I know of one case where, this was very extreme, but a teacher actually said to a child who was the wild, unruly, difficult child, was doing something hurtful to the good child who the teacher liked. Okay, the teacher said, "You'll, when you grow up, all you'll be able to say is, 'One day I polished his shoes.'" That's what you'll turn out to be. He said that to the wild child. Words could be a lot worse than hitting. What? I don't know what he turned out. It's not my kid. I don't know what happened to him. Okay, but certainly no way to go. Moving on. More things about keeping track of what we're doing and improving our middos, which is what we're supposed to be talking to, although we got very sidetracked. Okay, so he said you have to keep track of it. That means you have to every day. Did I say whenever you get around to it? No. Every day you have to review the past day. If you could write a journal, that's even better. But if not, you talk to Hashem in your own words. You say, this is what you gave me yesterday. You gave me health. I got out of my own bed. I wore clothes. I had more than one outfit to choose from. And here's what I did in the morning. I did this and this and this. And when I'm looking at it critically, I think I could have done it better. I could have done this and that. And I'll try harder. And I want your help. And I want to understand as I'm doing things what to choose. You have to bring him into your life. Then you move from yesterday and today. And today this is what I expect to be doing. You know what I'll be doing. But I'll need your help. I'm going to be going to work. I want to work with integrity. Give me clarity. I'm going to be dealing with people. Give me rachmanis. Okay, got this? You have to bring Hashem into the picture. Next, the next thing was chanun, which means giving for free. So we said racham, the next one was chanun. What does it mean to give for free? It means to give without any expectation of return. This is extremely important. This is important in our relationship with our spouses, with our children, with ourselves, with the Eibishter, with our spouses. One of the things that destroy marriages is bookkeeping. You know how that goes? We're going to your parents again. I don't know why, got this? Or all of the other forms of bookkeeping. The reason to give is if Hashem gives you something that you have, it's in order to move it forward. This is how you become a spiritual person. It doesn't matter if the books are balanced or not. You have to give without cheshbonos. The only cheshbon you make with giving, is it good for the recipient to receive this? If the answer is no, then you don't give it. But it should have nothing to do with what they've given you in the past and how the bookkeeping looks. Okay, clear? This would be true even in neighborly relationships. Your neighbor asks you a favor. Could you watch my kids? I have to go buy something. And you ask them for that five times. They always have an excuse. Makes you feel like a shmata to be the good one who they always come to. If you could watch their kids, then the answer is yes. If you can't, then the answer is no. Who they are is not in the picture. You have to give what you can. You only don't give what you can't. That's all. Why? Because your goal is to become a person who's more godlike, not a person who's more justified. This fear of shmatadom. You're familiar with this terrible fear? Okay, I even have heard a terrible thing. A speaker in Shalom Bayit once actually said to Kalas, no less, that they should be sure at the very beginning that, you know, that things are reciprocal, otherwise they'll become a shmata. Isn't that a good beginning? Okay, which is terrible advice. Okay, the people who are worried about shmatadom would think that Avraham Avinu was an idiot. You think these people are really so interested in your teaching? They're coming from the food, which probably was true. Okay, clear? So what? If someone's hungry, give them food. So what? Don't have strings attached to your giving. Certainly not to your spouse. With kids, don't expect anything in return. Don't get reciprocal. Okay, I've done this and this. The least you could do is clean your room. Okay, they should clean their room, not just because you've martyred yourself sufficiently. You know all of the Jewish mother jokes are true. You know this, like all of the stereotypes b'chlal are true. You know, like artistic people are really artsy, you know, like whatever. But, and there is a reason why people don't say blacks are good at business but Jews have rhythm. Yeah. But there's a reason for these cliches. Like it doesn't, just watching, like, you know, the middle-aged elephants doing the yeshiva, like, the yeshiva stumble at weddings is quite something. But in any case, so Jewish mothers have this penchant of thinking, the worse I feel, the more you owe me. Don't go there. No one is interested in making you feel bad, least of all your husband, who wants a happy wife more than he wants anything. Okay, certainly not your kids, who don't want guilt. So ask them for things because they need to be done. Ask them for things because it's good for their chinuch. But don't put guilt into this picture. Give freely. Okay, clear? Okay, the next one that was listed as being kadosh. Yeah? Yeah. What is it? What do you mean exactly when you say take advantage? That means you give what you don't have?
No, I don't have to say no to people. So, give and give.
So I'm saying, I'm asking you what the problem is.
So, yeah, no boundaries.
So what's the problem?
The problem is that at a certain point you have to say no.
Why?
Because it infringes on other areas of your life.
So what you have to do is make priorities. Making priorities isn't the same thing as learning to say no and not letting people take advantage. So it means if doing this for this person means you can't do that for someone else, and the someone else could be yourself, then you could say no because you don't have the time. But saying no as a life goal isn't valid in Judaism. Saying no to this because that's more important certainly is. Zemaisa with Hillel. Hillel was walking in the street. His Talmidim said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to feed someone poor." So he said, "Who?" And he said, "Me." Okay, so that's completely valid and appropriate. Okay, clear? Yeah.
I mean, a lot of times there are people that I don't know if I'm saying myself clearly, but
so yeah, I'm saying what you're saying is people don't respect people who don't stand up for themselves.
Not even to stand up for themselves, they don't say no sometimes, or like, or it's not equal. Like if you're always being so, oh, I'll do this for you and I'll do that, and a lot of people just don't respect you and will not treat you nicely.
So you're absolutely right. And if life was for getting respect from humans, there would be something to what you're saying, but it's not what life's all about.
Being stepped on is not either an action
for life. See, do you mean stepped on literally?
Not literally, but...
So what do you mean exactly?
Mistreated. They don't talk too nicely. They're not going to... They'll take from you.
So you give them freely whatever you have that's free. You don't give them what gets in the ways of other priorities. It has nothing to do with them. The only life you're leading is whose? Yours. That's up to them. And my observation is that people who don't treat someone well who does them favors don't treat people well if they don't do them favors either. Of course, that's right. They definitely will. The question is if that's your life's goal, that in order to get something from you, they have to be mechaved you. Is that your life's goal?
Yeah, but I don't have to be like walking around with everybody mistreating me either.
People, at first, everyone won't be mistreating. Okay.
But there are plenty of people.
So I'm saying mistreating, if mistreating means continually asking you for things, as long as you could say no, when you don't have what they want, you don't have the time or the energy or the material thing, then you're fine. There was a woman who would go to Rav Moshe Feinstein every week. He was so busy, and ask him when Shabbos is. Now, at some point, if this was me, I would have said, honey, there's a thing called a calendar. Okay. You know, buy yourself a can of Manischewitz fish on Rosh Hashanah, and it's all solved. Okay. He had no problem with this. He would just say, like, 4:15, have a good Shabbos, whatever. And the reason for this is because he didn't have, to him, helping someone in some way on one side of the scale and getting kavod on the other side of the scale. He wanted helping and he didn't want kavod. Okay, clear? That's only, you will become resentful, and I'll tell you when. If you think that giving has to be reciprocal and you notice you're not getting back what you get, what you give, you'll become resentful. Or if you thought you were getting kavod and that's what you really wanted, of course you'll be resentful. Right, so everyone should everyone should have good midos. Your neighbors should also have good midos. They should have hakaras hatov, and they should have tznius, and they should have yashrus, and they should have integrity in their business dealings, and they should never bank unless there's a heter ribis and a heter iska. Don't worry about your neighbor. Worry more about you in this regard. It doesn't have to. It doesn't have to. The only question I said, you don't have to go there unless you feel that you need the thank you. You're not worried about your neighbor's nevidus. That's not where it's coming from. So wean yourself off it because you're an adult. The only thing I will say is that part of your decision making, as I said, in giving, is you do have to see not only if you have what they need, but if giving it is good for them. Sometimes giving something creates expectations that can't be fulfilled. So that's something that you do have to sometimes consider. So enemies have to be fought, but not. We're not talking about people who are physically dangerous to you.
The people that are taking at one point, they become the enemy.
I don't think that that's true.
I've seen that with close neighbors taking.
And they became your enemies? They kidnapped your nephew?
They became very resentful.
I'll tell you what, when they become resentful, if your giving creates guilt on their side, they become resentful. So what I'm saying is you have to be careful in giving in a way in which they don't feel guilty. They feel it's okay, you really don't mind because the emes you don't, which means there has to be a certain level of sincerity. So oftentimes we're of two minds within ourselves, so we have to work on ourselves there. It's not easy. Right, that's what I'm saying. And I would add something. Oftentimes people reach the point where they thought that the only thing they could say is no, but Hashem gives them more than they ever dreamed they would have. I have a friend in Yerushalayim, some of you may have heard of her, Mrs. Machlis. You know who she is? So on an ordinary Shabbos, she has somewhere between 100 and 200 people. And she doesn't have an unusually large home. She has a regular Israeli home, but she puts up tables all over the place and on the porch and on the outside. And if you wonder, like, you go in the street, you see, like, you know, who invites that funny beggar who sits in the street and goes, okay, you don't have to call up beforehand. You could just show up. And she serves nicely. It's not just, now you know, 138 Malot Daphna. Okay. She serves nicely, meaning it's not, it's food that you would be happy to put on your own table served. She serves soup. I would have certainly skipped the soup course. Okay. I asked her, Henny, when do you begin? Now, what do you think I thought the answer would be? I would think Mitzvah Shabbos, that the cleaners come. She has a cleaner that they clean up, and then already she'll be, you know, Thursday afternoon. Just like me. So after I swallowed my normal resent and hateful and, you know, knee-jerk response, you do? Okay, whatever. Okay, so I said, how do you get into this? So she took me through the steps, you know. She doesn't work alone. People help her. You know, like she has other people in the kitchen with her. She has a large industrial sort of a stove now, which all the years she didn't. Okay. She said, I never expected to have this many people. Okay, I began to invite people who seemed to need a place, and they would bring others. And the more I did, the more Hashem sent me, and the more shefa and strength He sent me as well. She never planned this. She said she gets up in the morning, and she says, Hashem, I'll do whatever you want me to do. And it was not in her plan. So, and I've seen this with other people also, where if you asked, did you think you could do all of this? The answer is no, they never saw this. The present mayor of Yerushalayim, Rav Oriel Lupolyansky, he started Yad Sara, that lends out medical equipment, when someone in the family needed a piece of equipment. So he bought it, and then he bought another one to lend out. Now it's this huge international organization. In Africa, people from, I think it was Guinea, sent representatives to Yerushalayim to watch how Yad Sara works. Okay, nobody knows how many people, you know, because since it's international and the Goyim have copied it as well. I'm sure when he bought another pair of Canadian crutches, he didn't think that that's where it would be 25 years down the line. So Hashem oftentimes breaks open the borders. So you have to do what you can do.
Okay.
Yes, huge family, and they're all involved. Okay, they're all involved. And I remember one of them, which struck me as very funny. You know, people have like said, people can't get out of the box. You know, people think in the box. So one of her daughters finished high school, and she was speaking to someone from the school who was saying like, and what do you want to, you know, learn? So she said, I'm not sure I want to go to seminary. So she said, why? And she said, well, I've never been too academic, and, you know, I could help my mother. And the teacher was like on the floor scandalized. What do you mean? You have to have a future. You have to build yourself if you don't learn now. And I was like, this woman, what? She's learning more from her mother every day than she'll learn from anything she's going to learn in seminary. What is the problem here? Okay, clear? And she ended up going to seminary because the teacher pressured her so much.
Adult children. You say you can't give enough and they don't appreciate it.
So sometimes you have to ask whether it's good for them, because again, if you create artificial expectations that can't be maintained, so it's like spoiling a child, a young child.
Can you ask them, you know, like a stranger will not say, you know, you didn't do this and that. Can you do that to a child who has obligations to keep it away?
Could you? Yes. So it's tricky because once you have married children, you also have spouses of married children. And the relationship between a child and a parent is very different than between a daughter-in-law, a son-in-law, and a parent. So it's very hard to... It's a tightrope. So it's much...
The daughter-in-law is supposed to listen to you. I mean, that's how it works.
She is supposed to listen to you.
Your daughter has to listen to her first.
That's true. But if you don't want resentment and hostility, okay, then realize, if you don't want resentment and hostility, the inherent hostility between mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law is so great that Mishnah says that they're pasul la'edus one on the other, even in times of edus where women can give. So, because the assumption is that they might want to just ruin the other one's life on purpose. Okay, so it's not simple, it's a tightrope. Okay, having said that, okay, showing gratitude for kavod usually will bring more kavod when you're talking about adults. Saying it meant so much to me when you took me here or did that for me, it's like really something. That usually will inspire an adult to do more than being told, well, you're mechuy of this and mechuy of that. It usually works better.
No, when you do it for them, and then should you expect, you say, don't expect anything.
You expect hivud horim whether that you do anything for them or not. The kavod they owe you has nothing to do with what you give them.
Do you think that the young people think that, the married people think that?
So what I'm saying is that, well, it's the nature of things that people want more and more. So you have to make a very serious cheshbon, and sometimes you have to mityaetz with someone. Whether by giving them what it is that they think they need, you're not creating artificial expectations that will leave them to not appreciate what they have already. Because there is an issue of spoiling someone. So sometimes you have to be mityaetz with someone who's bigger and who is more familiar with the situation at hand. But there are situations where you could give them A and they just want B, I mean, for sure. But they have to give kavod whether you give them or not. Okay, yeah, this is... Okay. No, don't go there. Give them a punishment, but don't tell them about how you'll take revenge in the future. Okay, give them a punishment. I'm going to conclude with this, because I could see where something I said lends its... Huh? I'm supposed to stop now, no?
No.
What? I know, I'm missing Kadosh. That's what so let me just answer you this. There is something that I want you to consider, which is that you do, although you should give as much as you have to carefully watch what the other person needs. So in child raising specifically, not with your neighbors who you're not raising or being mechanech, but with your children, children need structure. They need borders. This is mashiken and this is mashalo. And my observation in Neve, where I see a lot of girls who are off the derech, now realize what I see it's not a good image, because the girls who are off the derech who come to Neve are the girls who are coming back. Otherwise they wouldn't be in Neve. So I don't know if this is so with girls who are off the derech, period. So realize I'm speaking about a very limited... But I have yet to see any girl so far who both felt understood and had really serious structure. Either they had no structure, no expectations, and were given far more than they could handle, or they didn't feel understood and validated. I haven't had somebody who had both. So I'm talking about tens and tens of girls. So again, it may be different boys and girls, it may be different girls who don't come back, but this has been my observation. So the one thing that you do have to watch is that your desire for your child's love or to give them doesn't supersede their need for real structure. So it means, for instance, you brought up children doing chores. It's good for children to be self-disciplined. It's good for them to know that there are things they have to do. Okay, so obviously the best way to get them to do it is by giving them a sense of gratification and achievement. But if you have to say, well, if you didn't do it, then no, and then, you know, no going out of the house the rest of the day until this is done. Or no going shopping if the only place your money can go is into clothes and you haven't bought the school books I gave you money to give to buy last week. Or no, you know, like, or whatever, no. Okay, no going out the rest of the week at night if you can't be back by 11. Okay, clear? Whatever no is, there has to be no, but it's not followed up by, if you do this to me, I'll do that to you, because that's like, it's a bad message in chinuch. Let's talk about, so again, it's not, there's no negotiation, no bargaining. If you do this, you're punished. Not if you do this, then I will do that, you know? Okay, clear? Kadosh. Okay, Kadosh means being separate from that which limits, and at the same time, focused. So there was a Havdalah Vahamtaka. What does that mean? Being Kadosh means being separate from the things that limit. Physicality, subjectivity, time, rising above that. And at the same time, being focused, not orbiting, okay? So to understand this better, in the Torah there's actually a mitzvah, kadoshim tiyu, be kadosh. So what are you supposed to do with this? So Rashi and Ramban say things that seem to be contradictory, but in fact they're more similar than you would think. Rashi says, have separation from all forms of promiscuity. And he says, wherever you find a geder erva, wherever there are fences against promiscuity, shama tamotze kedusha, that's where you'll find holiness. That's what Rashi says. Where does he get this from? In the previous parsha, Acharei Mot, the last topic under discussion were all of the forbidden relationships. Not this one, not that one, not the other one. And when the parsha ends, it's Ptucha. It's directly connected to the following parsha, which is Kedoshim Tiyu. So he says that means that these two things are connected. Ramban quotes Rashi, but takes it further. He says, no, all of the forbidden relationships are inherently forbidden. It just said, don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other. So what's the chiddush of Kedoshim Tiyu, if you're anyway not allowed to do this? So he says, no, it means something further. It means be separate from permissible physical pleasure. Not from what's usur, but from what's mutter. And he gives three examples, so we'll talk through the examples. The first, don't be a drunkard on kosher wine. Second, we all like that, because all right, we don't do that. Okay. Next, don't be a glutton on kosher food. Oh, no. Oh, okay. And the worst, I mean the last. Okay, don't drown in Gashmias. So we have to talk this through. Why here? Because it says, Rachum Chanun Kadosh. I didn't write this script. So the idea is as follows. We have only so much emotional energy. I'm not talking about physical capacity. I'm talking about emotional energy. If it's going here, it's not going there. That's the way it goes. So let's go back to Rashi with Arayot. We have to go back further still. Okay, Cain and Hevel, that's what were fighting. What were they fighting about? What was the reason that they had the quarrel that led? No, that was after the quarrel. In other words, okay. What? They were fighting for the world. So Cain said, the earth is mine. Hevel said, the heavens are mine. Cain then said, don't step on my earth. And Hevel then said, don't breathe my air. But this is deeper than it sounds. What they were really fighting about was whether the earth and everything in it should be viewed as Ruchani or Gashmi. So because of this, the Midrash says that they were fighting. The focus of the fight was possibly the Makom HaMikdash. Is that a place that's primarily a physical place to which people have attached spiritual significance? Or is it primarily a spiritual reality that happens to be embodied in physicality? That's one view. But the other view, and this is what's relevant to us, is that there were two sons of Adam, but three daughters. They were arguing over the extra sister. So the issue is marriage primarily physical? He supports me financially, and I make the food, okay, or sexual in that regard? Or is it primarily spiritual? What is it? Okay, so the answer is obviously that it's both, but the question is which dominates. So therefore, Rashi says that a geder erva, which means not being involved in forbidden physical relations, tells us that physicality isn't meant to dominate. So yes, there should be physicality in a relationship, but it's a means towards an end, which is spiritual kesher.
How did you say you know it's not meant to dominate?
Again, because after you have all of the forbidden arayot, we're enjoyed kadoshim to you. That's not enough not to have forbidden relationships. There's something further than that. So that means that the physical side of the relationship is what? A means towards an end, which is spiritual bonding. So anything that doesn't have a spiritual address in the end isn't good. Now we could understand Ramban. Let's talk about drinking kosher wine. Drinking kosher wine is good. Towards an end, enjoying Shabbos, enjoying Yom Tov, I don't know what else one would drink wine, the Simcha, Kiddush. Okay, if Hashem is in the picture, you're celebrating what he did through the wine. The wine is a means, and the end is spiritual bonding. The same holds true with food, I blush to say. Okay, how much is gluttony, by the way, do you know? How many of you don't want to know? Okay, so gluttony is eating when you're not hungry. Okay, you know, the seafood diet, all of those. So the idea there is that food is a wonderful means towards an end. Not just this, you have to keep your body alive through eating, in which case, no doubt, eating brown rice and water with a little tahina would suffice. Okay, but to enjoy the pleasure of Hashem having given us so much, the color, the taste, the texture, it's a way he gives us a gift. So when anyone gives a gift out of love, you should return that love, which is what saying brachas are about. Which is why when people ask the Amshin of a Rebbe, how could I have a relationship with Hashem? The first thing he always says is say one bracha on food a day with simcha. Okay, but if it takes on its own life, then it just draws you further away. The same thing holds true with all of the Gashmi things. The clothing, the furniture, the trips, all of the Gashmi, the car, all of the Gashmi pleasures that we have. If there are means towards an end, that's one thing. If they take on their own life, it's a whole other thing. So being Kadosh means not letting Gashmias take on its own life. So you have a car. That's an efficient way to do what? Get from here to there. And if you have money, it may be better to get one that's comfortable and large and quiet. Yeah? Okay. But it's not more than that. Its purpose is still to get you conveniently, quietly, whatever, from what? Here to there. It's not, shouldn't be an object of your affection. Okay, so we can live for that because by and large, who gets enwrapped with the cars emotionally? Men. Your home. Your home. It would be terrible to live outdoors. It would be cold. It would be dirty. You should live somewhere. It should be indoors. It should be large enough to accommodate all of the people comfortably. It should be aesthetically pleasing. And that's it. Okay? That means if it becomes something that you're emotionally involved with. I have to tell you a terrible story. Do you know who Rav Jacobson is?
Who?
Rav Jacobson. He's a very famous mechanech in Eretz Israel, but very, very well known. He deals, amongst other chinuch issues, with off-the-derech boys. So he had the son of a Rosh Yeshiva with him. And of course the boy had all of these accusations against his family, coming from his own guilt or whatever. So one of the things he said was, "My father's not even sincere." So Rav Jacobson said, "How do you see this?" So he said, "My father is a very serious man." He said, "Yes. The only time I saw him really joyous was when they brought in Italian ceramics to the kitchen when they were doing it over." So why am I telling you this sad story? Is that people do get emotionally involved in the gashmius of their home. And it's a mistaken thing. Have it. Enjoy it. Use it. It's a means towards an end. Gives you a certain sort of tranquility and headspace. But that's it. Okay, clear? The same holds true with clothing. It keeps you covered, keeps you warm. Yeah?
But when you say enjoy it and that's it, and not get involved in gashmias, but people, a person could be happy, satisfied with cheaper tiles and plainer tiles, or she'll be maybe, it's not going to come out right, happier with Italian designer name tiles, anything.
So
furniture. I don't know what you mean. You say and happy, and that's it. There's no limit with gashmias.
So what I'm saying is, not status, not emotional involvement. You bought it because you needed it. Now enjoy it and don't think about it anymore. There are people who have these, you know, they send the free magazines in the mail with all the things that you could buy that inform you of what you need. There are people with stacks like this, and they look through it, you know, like all the time. Don't go there. If you have a floor, then don't think about a new floor unless this one breaks. Your walls are painted, they're not chipped. Don't think about wall decorations until something happens. Okay, your car is taking you from here to there. Don't look at car magazines. Okay, got this? Yeah?
Just before you finish,
yeah.
I just want to say when I was there, Rabbi Baer sent me to Rabbi St. Judy Soloveitchik, Rabbi Zadok's
wife. Yeah.
So I went.
Yeah.
And he's very big on this. Go, and she's Mitzvah Bemuach, so I went, and I'm talking to her, and I said, you know, I heard something, a story about your daughter. She says, I'll tell you the story. My daughter told me, Ma, upstairs, so-and-so, the neighbor redid the kitchen. It is gorgeous. You have to see the cabinets. It's beautiful. Rabbi St. Judy said to her, what do I need to look at her cabinet, her kitchen for? I look at my own kitchen. I don't need to look at her kitchen. Mm-hmm. If I needed to do a kitchen, then I would look.
Right.
But I don't have to. Meanwhile, between us, like, her floor was ripped up. Her bookshelves were, like, falling apart and sagging and, like...
Yeah, so they're holding the books, which is for both of them all they need. Like,
you know. Until it breaks.
Yeah, then they'll buy a new one. Okay, they'll ask the upstairs neighbor, where do you buy bookshelves? So there are two views. There are two views. One view is that gashmius becomes so distracting. It becomes so emotionally distracting and time-wise distracting that the less you look and the less you think and the less, okay, and be mistopic with what you have, which doesn't mean feeling deprived. I'm not talking about deprivation. So I want to explain to you the difference between mistopic, b'mu'at, and deprivation. Okay, here's how this works. I want you to picture this image. This is going to be a very hard image. Okay, I went with somebody to this fancy restaurant in, where was it, Lakewood or Muncie? I don't remember where it was. Okay, a French restaurant, a Jewish form restaurant, very expensive.
It wasn't Muncie.
It must be Lakewood. Okay, it was Lakewood. Okay, this fancy place where, it's not that much in the decor, but a very fancy restaurant. I want you to picture a fancy form restaurant. You're there, you can see it in your mind's eye. So you know how, when you buy a raffle, they always offer you a big prize, and then it'll say, and lots more, okay? So this is true in Yerushalayim as well. And in Yerushalayim, there are fancy restaurants too. Okay, clear? So picture this. This actually happens. I'm just giving you a reference with a restaurant, but it happened with something other than a restaurant. So there was this hagrala that Yated was running. And you could buy, I don't remember what tzedakah it was for, it's from some important tzedakah. And the way it worked is you could buy tickets, but if you were a Yated subscriber, that bought you an automatic ticket. In other words, if you were a Yated subscriber without doing anything to get a ticket, you already had one and you could buy more. So the way this raffle worked was through computer. I don't know enough about computers to know how, but whatever, the program was that whatever number was picked, number like 8,400 and whatever, the computer, you press a button, and the computer knows which ticket matches that number, okay? So the people didn't have to read the ticket numbers to know that they won. Okay, clear? So the next thing that happened, of course, this is all computer, is that they published in Yated the winning ticket numbers and the names of the people who won and what it is that they won and where they have to call to get the thing that they won delivered. So, you know, there was like the first prize, which was something very big, and, you know. And then you get down to the countless others, right? Remember that? There was a fancy towel set that was won by, are you ready? Yud Shin El Yashiv on Ten Hanan. Okay. Now, I'm sure you didn't read Yated, but whatever. But I'm sure with whichever grandson read Yated that morning, and when he said, Vuseretzuch, yeah, and wanting to know what's new, like in 2 minutes, Tamtzit, he would say, and you won towels, right? Now, on a 1 to 10 scale of overwhelming joy, you know, like, let's assume that they're very large and soft and pastel, and I don't know what else a towel could possibly be. Embroidered, monogrammed, you know, like, whatever. Okay, Egyptian cotton, whatever. Is this going to make his day? No. Is he going to go to the trouble of picking it up? No. At most, the grandson will say, can I have it? And he'll say yes, and the grandson will pick it up. Okay, clear? Okay, why? Is that because he's into self-deprivation? No, it's because he doesn't have the mind space for this kind of nonsense. He's too busy for it. You take a shower, you dry yourself, you get out, and that's it. Like, you don't need to have... Okay, whatever. It's not deprivation. So one view is to be mimayet, but not from a place of deprivation, from a place of having so much going on in your life that you don't have time for the nonsense. The other view is, since Hashem provides everything out of love, that you don't turn a gift aside ever, and that you should have things, that you should surround yourself with whatever your means allow you to have. Obviously, nobody thinks that you should exceed your means or spend all of your time working so you have no time for a life. But whatever your means allow should be beautiful and you should enjoy it. So, for instance, the late Vizhnitzer Rebbe, not the present Rebbe, would ask people to bring him an apple so he could say a bracha and enjoy the apple and see Hashem's greatness in the apple. Okay, clear? So these are two different views. So he wouldn't say have less. He would say have what you have, but enjoy it. But even there would never be as an end. It would be as a means. So that's what Kedusha means. So you guys have a big problem with this, and I'll tell you what your problem is. You live in America. And the Ruach HaZman is not one of Kedusha in this regard. And our kids are, you know, they breathe in the air. They breathe in the air. And because they breathe it in the air, and people are only people, we sometimes even fan the flames. You understand what I mean? Okay, you're so deserving, I'll buy you this Gashmi object that you don't need or really want. Okay, clear? So you have to be careful. I think that this is probably the biggest Nisayan in America today.